all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossum.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach it at 800-693-4800. On Veterans Radio today, our guest is Daniel C. Sullivan, Strategy and Communications Liaison for Burn Pits 360. Dan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, thanks, Jim. I'm glad to be here and glad to be able to speak on behalf of Burn Pits 360 today.
Well, we want to bring to our listeners topics that are of interest to veterans, their friends, and their family members, and certainly one that for Iraq and Afghanistan veterans hasn't received much attention and really should, is this whole issue of exposure to burn pits. But why don't we start, Dan? Tell us what burn pits are and the concerns related to them.
Sure. So burn pits essentially, as I understand it, were meant to be a temporary trash refuse disposal method on military bases at the beginning of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. They were an expedient. They were developed basically as an expedient way of getting rid of the abundant refuse of military conflict at the early stages of the war, because there were no other alternatives. The directive, as I understand it, again, was that these, because of the health risks known by the Environmental Protection Agency and other medical authorities, there are, because of the known health risks of burning trash in an open pit, it's illegal to do that pretty much everywhere in the mainland United States. Because of these health risks, they were going to replace these pits with safer incinerators. But unfortunately, it appears that this did not happen very quickly, and there are likely still burn pits burning right now. So there are burn pits basically are large pits. When we talk about them, we're generally talking about pits on military bases, but the fact of the matter is that I understand it that trash burning is also fairly prevalent in open pits by the populations of Iraq and Afghanistan as well. Everyone burns trash. And we're also talking about, trash could be burned in a big container. The term burn pit is kind of like a starting point of exposure. But the classic burn pit is a large pit on a military base like Balad, in which substances are burned that produce toxins that are known to be hazardous to human health
And these are I've seen a list of known burn pit locations, and there are, this isn't one or two. This is 100 or more of these at everything from pretty well known camps in Iraq or Afghanistan, to forward operating bases, to the Baghdad International Airport. I mean, it was prevalent all over the theater in Iraq and Afghanistan, if I understand it right.
That's my understanding as well. And there's actually a document that military personnel fill out on the way back from deployment called Post-Deployment Health Questionnaire. And on that document, you can mark whether or not you were exposed to burning trash. I don't know that anyone ever looks at this document after it's completed, but I know of it because my brother was a Marine. He was deployed to Iraq. He marked that he was exposed to burning trash, and he was dead of illness 4 years after he returned from Iraq. No one ever discussed the health risks of burning trash with him, or looked at that document.
Well, yeah. And again, we thank you for your family sacrifice as a Gold Star family here with your brother. One of the things I think it's somewhat misleading on when we just say it's burning trash in open pits is that we here in the United States might have, well, you're talking leaves and cardboard and
sure.
stuff, but tell us a little bit about what was thrown into these pits to have burned and the incomplete combustion of those materials.
Right. So I guess the part of the problem we have is that we know what was thrown in the pits and we don't know what was thrown in the pits because so much was thrown in them and there was really no control over what was being thrown in them. But my understanding is there were body parts thrown in there, plastics, munitions, metals, it just basically anything could have been thrown in there. When you look at the examine, I think what's most important from my perspective, and I think from the medical perspective, is what's coming out of it versus what's going into it. You know, the stuff thrown into it can sound very disgusting. What's really important is what is coming out of it. And when you look at the list of chemicals produced by the burn pits in the, there's a document that was produced by the Institute of Medicine, now known as the National Academies of Science, of the Sciences, called, the Long-Term Health Effects of, Burn Pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you can read the entire thing, the Long-Term Health Consequences of Exposure to Burn Pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. You can read the whole document online at nationalacademies.org. And there's a chapter in there that describes the chemicals that came out of the Balad burn pit and the diseases associated with those chemicals. One of them is dioxin, the same chemical which was the leading cause of the problems associated with Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. So we're talking about some serious exposures that were occurring. And some seriously deadly chemicals coming out of these pits that we know were coming out of.
So this is a, I think most veterans would say, a serious health concern. How has VA approached the handling of exposure to the plumes of smoke that a military member might be exposed to, or how do they view it?
Well, the VA's approach is difficult to characterize because the VA is such a large entity and there are so many different pieces of it that different pieces of it will address the issue in different ways. I think from a public health perspective, the VA has not fulfilled its obligation under the Burn Pit Registry Act to have a large public health information campaign in which it's supposed to disseminate to veterans information about the health risks of burn pits. And if you look at the VA's website, you can see that they have done multiple press releases about post-traumatic stress disorder and absolutely zero press releases on burn pits and the Burn Pit Health Registry. So to me, that does not seem like the public health component of the law is being followed, or that the VA's communications department is communicating what the scientific divisions of the VA know. In other words, there is data that the VA has collected in various portions of the VA and will share with certain individuals like me or Rosie Torres, the executive director of Burn Pits 360, about the health risks of burn pits, about actual people that they have diagnosed as having burn pit related illnesses. But this information is being held within certain divisions of the VA, and it's not being widely publicized. The other element of this is that I have heard that it is very difficult to access benefits related to burn pit exposures at this time because there is no service-connected presumption. So the we don't know the exact rate of the denial of the claims. That's something we're trying to figure out. Basically, the VAs, I think if you were to sum it up as a whole, that there are things like places within the VA, such as the War-Related Illness and Injury Study Centers, which are aware of burn pits and which, if you can get to them, will probably diagnose you with a burn pit-related illness if you have one. But in order to actually even know that these facilities exist would take a fair amount of digging, because people within the VA itself don't even know that there are war-related illness and injury study centers. These are were created as a result of the Persian Gulf War of 1991 and legislation related to the illnesses that veterans got after that war. So really what we're seeing here is a continuum of a lack of a robust response to environmental and occupational illnesses following deployment. I think that's the best way that I can characterize what's happening at the VA.
I think you're right, Dan. We're talking to Dan Sullivan, who's the strategy and communications liaison for Burn Pits 360. In our experience here, in talking to veterans, the medical nexus between, hey, I was exposed to burn pit smoke for the 12 months I was over there, and this is the disease I have, because there isn't a presumption, it's almost impossible to make that correlation, because you don't have data of what was really coming out of the pit. We don't have data of what was thrown in the pit. So it's a very challenging issue on an individual-by-individual veteran basis, which brings us back to Burn Pits 360 as an organization. Tell us a little bit about what the advocacy is that you're doing in that organization.
Sure. So Burn Pits 360 was developed initially as an independent registry of where veterans and family members of veterans, of deceased veterans, could register exposure to burn pits in an independent registry, because there was no, at the time Burn Pits 360 was founded, there was no VA registry. There was no federal registry. There were no state or local registries. So it was essentially the first registry, and it still exists and still as a registry and still collects information, which is analyzed by independent scientists. And collect data that the VA doesn't collect, and we're advocating actually for the development of state registries that collect data that the VA registry does not collect, such as deaths and certain illnesses and diseases that we know are associated with the chemicals that were found in burn pits, but which the VA is not collecting in the current registry. Burn Pits 360, it starts with the exposure of the burn pit itself. The term 360 is meant to refer to essentially the widening circle, the circle of exposures, of toxic exposures around the burn pit, and our ever increasing knowledge of the multiple exposures that service members experience while deployed, particularly in the Iraq and Afghanistan region, and how these the interplay of the multiple exposures can create complex environmental and occupational illnesses. And we're working with within our own organization and with other organizations such as Amnesty International USA to essentially brief policymakers and decision makers at the local, state, and federal level about the nature of these exposures and the existence of environmental and occupational illnesses that result from these exposures, that these are simply scientific facts and medical facts that have been mischaracterized by the VA starting in 1991, essentially, as unexplained symptoms or Gulf War syndromes or whatever they came up with from a communications perspective. What we're actually talking about here is widely understood and well recognized within the medical community on mainland United States as occupational and environmental illnesses and occupational environmental medicine. And then the benefits that as a grateful nation we owe to our veterans who have occupational and environmental illnesses, we are advocating that that the law be followed and that the benefits be provided to veterans for their service.
So the pressure sort of built on VA, and they finally, in only 3 short years ago, in June of 2014, opened their airborne hazards and open burn pit registry for veterans and service members. And one of the things you can go register on that at VA, and part of that was they also then were supposed to take that data and see if there were any conclusions that could be drawn. And the National Academy of Science in February of 2017 looked at the data and came to some conclusions. Can you tell us about the conclusions?
Sure. The National Academy came up with some very good recommendations on improving the registry. I would say that the bulk of the report involves recommendations that are fairly consistent with recommendations made by advocacy groups for improvement of the registry, improvement of dissemination of knowledge about the registry. There is a slight problem, however, though, that one of the recommendations kind of invalidates all of the other recommendations, which is essentially, it's less of a recommendation and more of a, no, it is a recommendation. I think it recommended that the VA communicate that essentially the registry data being collected is of limited use from a scientific perspective.
I read this and I sort of went, well, why did you do it then? Because you knew it. The objection, listeners to Veterans Radio, and we're talking to Dan Sullivan, Strategy and Communications Liaison for Burn Pits 360. The National Academy said, well, that 2014 registry was nice, but since it relies on voluntary participation and self-reported information, it makes it fundamentally unsuitable for addressing the question of whether burn pit exposure results in health problems. Well, that was
right.
and a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah, but the statement coming from the National Academy of Science is just simply dead wrong. I mean, if you look at the actual science of environmental health registries, which you can, if you search PubMed environmental health registry, and you can read the abstracts of environmental and occupational medicine specialists that say very clearly that environmental health registries in various contexts are important, and especially one of the key elements of this registry wasn't just to collect data, it's also to serve as a communication tool where the VA is supposed to be communicating, using the registry to communicate to veterans what the known health risks of exposure to the chemicals known to be having been emitted from burn pits are, so that they can be, so that vets can go to the doctor, get pre-screened, get a special, there's actually a special evaluation that the VA claims to offer, which apparently it doesn't actually offer, to evaluate a person for lung illnesses and other illnesses. No, it's called a burn pit registry health evaluation. So what the Academy was saying was essentially that from an epidemiology perspective, the registry is of limited use. Okay, well, that's probably true because it's not an epidemiological instrument. It is what it is. It's a registry, and it is useful as a registry. I think the wording of that, I'm not sure exactly where it makes it sound like they're saying it's really of no use. What they're really saying is kind of a little twisted. It's not of use in a certain type of science. But there's a lot of people out there that say that environmental health registries are useful from a clinical perspective, are useful for are useful for helping determine future epidemiology.
Well, as you mentioned, Dan, and I think this is important for our listeners to understand, if they were exposed to burn pit smoke and they are not on the registry, you should be on the registry because it's a communication tool. In the future, hopefully VA will be using it as a communication tool to reach out to you because you've identified yourself as such. There are about 64,000 veterans on the registry. So, you know, it's a pretty big pool to begin with, but there's many more people who haven't even heard that they should register, and maybe the registry won't make this medical nexus issue or epidemiology, can hardly say that word, connection at the moment, but it should be used in the future as a communication tool, it would seem.
Right. Well, it could be, whether or not it actually will. My understanding, I've asked a number of vets who are registered whether they've ever received a communication from the VA, and they've all said no. So I guess it's not being used in the way that the law says it's supposed to be used. If the VA spent over $1 million, according to its own statements, developing the technology for the Burn Pit Registry, which, as I understand it, is actually horrible, and it's like takes people forever to complete because it keeps crashing. They said they were going to spend $1.something million on that, $70,000 on education, the public information campaign. So that kind of pretty much sums up where the VA is on implementing the awareness, telling people that this thing exists. Most of the money went into developing technology that doesn't work very well, and very little money went into telling people about the registry and that it exists.
I know you spend time keeping track of what Congress is doing. Dan Sullivan, Strategy and Communications Liaison for Burn Pit 360. Can you tell us, is Congress still working on this issue of getting it right for veterans who were exposed to burn pit toxic exposures?
I think that Congress is working on the issue, and actually Burn Pits 360 in association with Amnesty International USA is planning, we hope relatively soon, to do a congressional briefing so that we can, to have a congressional briefing on this issue so that more members of Congress are aware of what's actually going on. There are bills being proposed to develop special treatment centers for burn pit. I think it's called the Helping Veterans Exposed to Toxic Chemicals Act. It's been on the table now for a few years. But in terms of accountability, in terms of Congress holding the VA accountable for following the laws that are passed to help veterans, I'm not sure that that's going on right now, because if Congress was holding the VA accountable for following, for example, just the first burn pit registry law, then you would think that there would be some more in public information, education, and outreach going on.
So Dan, if as we come to the end of our segment, if people want to be more involved on this issue, more educated on this issue, how do they stay in touch with Burn Pits 360, and where do you direct them? What recommendations do you have?
Sure. Well, we have our primary resource right now is our website, which is www.burnpits360.org. Now, this website has a lot of, there are a lot of resources on the website that veterans can use in order to get a sense of the known health effects of burn pit, of exposure to burn pits, and some documents produced by the VA itself on those known health effects. Okay, and our website was developed by a while ago. And I have good news, which is that we have a very generous donor who is going to construct for us within the next few months an entirely new website, which will be even more useful and have even more resources. So I would say that the best way to get in touch and stay connected with Burn Pits 360 is to go to the website, join our Facebook page, which is, I think you can find that just by saying, typing burnpits360.org. Join our mailing list, which would be, you can get to through our Facebook page, so you get our newsletter. And we are trying to get more people engaged in writing letters to Congress about what in directly telling their stories publicly, so that we can get the public as a whole to understand what's going on in terms of the these exposures and the illnesses related to them, so that we can get Congress to understand and act, and so that we can have a collaboration with the VA and the DOD, so that we can all kind of come together, the lawyers, the doctors, the government officials, the policymakers, and actually create that safety net, which as a society we want to have there for our heroes as they return.
Well, I want to end with a quote that I see that Rosie Torres, the founder of Burn Pits 360, has said, which is, quote, "We need a medical screening process in place now, not in 20 years, end of the quote. And I think that really sums it up. Let's not repeat the mistakes of the past. Dan Sullivan, great. Thank you for spending some time with Veterans Radio today to get the message out.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Our guest today may be the farthest away that we've ever had on Veterans Radio. We're going to talk today with Greg Lovett, who's the producer-director of a film regarding burn pits. Greg, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. You are over in Europe, in Holland, at the moment. So we're glad that we could make this connection and bring you to our Veterans Radio listening audience here in the United States.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, Greg, tell us a little bit about the documentary that you are in the process of finalizing called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers.
So about maybe about a year and a half ago, or possibly 2 years ago now, I read a book by a man named Joseph Hickman called The Burn Pits. I read a lot of nonfiction, and it was one of those books that kind of, to be honest, just sort of pisses you off. It's sad, but it also makes you really mad when you find out what is happening to soldiers who served overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I had never heard about burn pits until I read this book, in which he described how the Army was confronted with the problem of garbage, what to do with garbage, and how to get rid of garbage. And their solution on all these military bases, on about 200 bases throughout Iraq and Afghanistan, was to burn the garbage. So they threw all the junk that's accumulated in war into these big open-air pits. And when I say everything, I mean literally everything, from plastics, rubber, to dead animals, amputated body parts, medicine, even vehicles. And then they would set it on fire and burn it. And depending on the base that you were at, they may have been, quote-unquote, little burn pits, but some of them, like in Balad, in northern Iraq, was the size of several football fields and burned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So fast forward 10 years later, these soldiers are home and they're getting sick. And they're contracting illnesses that they really shouldn't be getting. A lot of these men and women who served overseas were, of course, healthy, and now they're contracting all kinds of illnesses, from respiratory problems to rare forms of cancers. And when you do the research and really look at the facts, you can link this back to their exposures from the burn pits.
And Greg, as you read this book, and it's sort of, you know, as I say, it's interesting in a piss you off kind of way. How did that move you then to saying, I need to get this story out? I need to tell this in a different manner, and sort of lead you to the documentary film approach?
Well, I've been working in television my whole life. I've lived in Holland now for about 30 years, but before that in the U.S. when I was younger, my father worked in television, so I kind of grew up in the business. So I was producing, directing shows there. And for about the first 10 years in Holland, I also had my own production company and produced shows. But for about the last 10 or 15 years, I had kind of moved more into management. So I'd been involved with different kinds of multimedia projects and internet and digital television and that kind of thing. And it was about the time I read the book that I was sort of thinking I'd love to return back to my roots. I'd like to get back into production again. But I wasn't really interested in, you know, game shows or quiz shows or talent shows or the kind of thing that's popular on TV. I'm kind of at an age now where I think I'd like to do something that makes a difference. So I was sort of looking for a project to begin with, trying to think of an interesting idea. And when I read the book, to be honest, I thought, well, somebody's going to make a documentary about this. So, you know, that's going to be cool. Good for them. But then after about 6 months went by or so, last summer, really, I thought, you know, I talked to a couple people that I contacted from the book, and I started going on the internet, a little bit and finding people, and nobody was telling me that they had been contacted by any other producer. So then I just thought, well, there's no time like the present. This could be my project. And from a personal point of view, it has all the things I was looking for. It has emotion, and it has drama, and it has, you know, controversy. And those are the kind of things that you also look for to create a documentary. It has to be interesting and moving. It has to keep people watching. And I thought it had an important message to tell. And I hope that if I could get it finished, that it might help to create awareness and really maybe make a difference.
Well, I think that's one of the things that on Veterans Radio, we try to tell these stories, because so many people are not aware of what's going on. And you know, they may not sit down and read a book that Joe Hickman wrote called The Burn Pits, but they will take an hour of time and watch your documentary. Tell us what's inside the documentary. Who are the people you interviewed? Is it just soldiers? Is there science involved? Tell us a little bit about the documentary.
Well, the story of how the documentary got made is actually interesting in itself, because obviously I'm over here in Holland, and the post-production could be done over here, but all the production work had to be done in the U.S., and I didn't have $100,000 to produce a documentary. So what I first did was I researched, who do I want to talk to? So I've talked to six soldiers, some who are terminally ill. I think about four soldiers actually appear in the documentary. I was scheduled to talk to more, but unfortunately, one died, one is now bedridden. So some of them were actually too sick to even appear. And so what I did when I found out who I wanted to talk to was I literally went on the internet and contacted some production companies locally. So for example, I interviewed a man by the name of Jesse Baca in New Mexico. So I found a production company in New Mexico that was willing to work with me, and they conducted the interview for me in New Mexico, and then one in Oklahoma and one in Oregon. And these people are all professional production people who are working, I don't want to say on a volunteered basis, but let's say for deferred payment. They provided their services at no cost, because once they heard about the story, they decided that they wanted to get involved. And that's the case for about the 15 or 20 people that I interviewed. I did interview several doctors, one in New York and one at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. Both of these doctors have been conducting research for the past 10 years, and they're both convinced that the illnesses that they're coming across can only be caused by toxic exposure. I've talked to a lawyer because a number of the soldiers are involved in a lawsuit against KBR. I mean, that's a whole other story in itself. KBR was a daughter company of Halliburton, and they had the waste management responsibilities on a number of these bases.
They were a private contractor that the United States government paid, I'm sure, boatloads of money to to manage this waste stream and waste disposal. Go ahead, continue.
And they didn't do it correctly. They were supposed to follow certain regulations, including EPA regulations in the states. They were supposed to treat these bases like little pieces of America, which by definition means you can't burn anything in open air. Well, obviously, they didn't do it, so they're being sued. So the lawyer appears in the documentary. I speak to a man by the name of Rick Lamberth, who actually worked for KBR. So he has firsthand knowledge of the mismanagement and of the cover-up that, KBR committed. So it's a wide range of people that have different points of view that I hope come together to tell the story very clearly and concisely, and I think we get the message across pretty well that it's not only an issue of six soldiers, but it's also the politics of how KBR got the contract and how they mismanaged it. It also goes into a little bit about the treatment that they are getting, or I should say not getting, by the VA, because the government and the VA still deny that these soldiers are sick because of their exposure to burn pits. That means that they can't always get the treatment that they need, and so they become sicker, or in cases of some people, they have to pay for the treatment themselves. One soldier I talked to appears in the documentary has $250,000 worth of debt because of health costs that is not covered. So it's a big story with a lot of issues in it.
Well, and that's what I wanted to get across to our veteran radio listeners. We're talking to Greg Lovett, who's the producer, director of a upcoming documentary called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers, focused on the use of burn pits in Afghanistan and Iraq. What's really different, I think, too, is that, you know, the waste streams that were being burned today as compared to 30 or 40 years ago, because this method is that, you know, it's been used time immemorial. It's a pretty crude way to get rid of stuff is to burn it. But now it's full of batteries and appliances and plastics and computer chips and all kinds of toxic parts that get, you know, pieces that get thrown into these burn pits. Is that what you found from your talking to the soldiers?
That's exactly right. They said that literally everything had to be disposed of in these burn pits, because there was no other place to get rid of the garbage. Now, there's a debate about why didn't they bury it? Why didn't they ship it out? Why did they use incinerators? That's a whole other issue, because according to Senator Udall of New Mexico, incinerators were budgeted for, and KBR received money for incinerators, which would have burned everything at much higher temperature and would have deposited less toxins into the air. But they didn't use incinerators. So that's another issue. Nobody knows exactly why. And when you look at things like plastic water bottles, for example, I believe the average soldier in Iraq in the middle of summer uses 10 water bottles per day. Well, if you've got 20,000 people on a base, that's 200,000 water bottles, plastic water bottles that you're just burning every single day. So never mind just the plastic, but like you said, it's old computers, it's trucks. The trucks that were abandoned or damaged or couldn't be repaired were just thrown in. And one of the doctors talks about how he found pieces of metal in the lungs of soldiers. Well, how else did it get there if it wasn't for the burn pits?
And one of the things that I think anybody who's been around a burn pit knows is you have a lot of what I'll call incomplete combustion. It doesn't really burn everything up like an incinerator is supposed to do. It catches it on fire to a certain point, and then the particulate matter floats away in the wind. It's incomplete combustion. Did any of your scientists talk about those kinds of problems of what we were putting into the atmosphere?
Yes. I mean, one of the soldiers, kind of made a joke, but he said, you know, we're supposed to breathe clean air, and anything in the air can cause disease. So just anybody who's allergic to pollen or something, of course, knows that. So anytime you're burning anything, it's going to damage you. And we have video of these huge plumes of black smoke that are just sitting over the base where the soldiers worked and ate and slept. And some of the soldiers describe it as thick as fog. And they all say that you actually had to wipe the dust off you. It would actually just fall on you. That's how much it was, how thick it was. One soldier even mentioned how one of their jobs was just cleaning the airplanes from the dust of the burn pits because it would prevent airplanes from flying. So it was actually something you could see, you could smell. It would burn their nose, it would burn their throat, it would settle on their clothes, and obviously also in their lungs.
One of the things that is sometimes more convincing than words are the photos, the images. Were you able to find both videos and maybe satellite photographs or regular photographs of these burn pits to communicate the size and extent of them?
We were. It was tricky because at the time that the soldiers were serving, they didn't really think about it in the most cases. They didn't really think about that it was dangerous. Some of them just believed what they were told, which is it's not harmful, so they just thought, okay. So the majority of soldiers serving didn't think about making pictures or making videos. Having said that, I was able to find some soldiers who made, I guess they weren't iPhone videos back then because we didn't have iPhones, but very low resolution, bad quality video. But you can definitely see what it was like and what a burn pit really consisted of. There are some good images in the documentary, I think, of everything from smoldering pits, like you said before, where everything is not really burned. It's just sort of sitting there smoldering. And then we also have images of these huge plumes of smoke that just go, I mean, I don't know how many feet, but a lot of feet, 50 feet or so is what one soldier told me, into the air and floating over the barracks. So we were able to get some images to convey what it must have been like for the soldiers living there.
And Greg Lovett, producer and director of this documentary, were you able to find anybody either in the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, the Veterans Administration? Would any of those officials go on camera and take a position that you were able to incorporate into the documentary on burn pits?
They wouldn't talk to me. I did reach out to people at the Department of Defense and to KBR, for example, but they didn't want to speak. But I was able to find some archive material. For example, there's a man who used to work for the Department of Defense who talks about how they, being the military, conducted their own study into the burn pits and found out that there was nothing wrong. It was not harmful to live and work near the burn pits. Now, of course, I have other people in the documentary who refute that and talk about how that study was flawed. And I do have some archive material from KBR's lawyer who claims that they were just, you know, doing what they were told to do and it's not their problem. And of course, then I have the man who used to work for KBR who said, well, we weren't doing what we were told to do. We knew what we were doing was wrong and we did it anyway.
Well, I think this is a informative topic and an aggravating documentary, and I mean that in high praise. I hope you take it that way, Greg. Tell us how the documentary is coming along and when it will be out and how people might view it and follow it.
Well, we actually just finished the documentary yesterday, which would have been the 22nd of May. We're just putting the last little frames or bars of music on, so it's basically done. Your second question is a little bit more difficult to answer because the life of a documentary filmmaker involves a lot of sales. So I have to go out now and sort of pitch it to, you know, the Netflixes and the HBOs and the Showtimes of the world and see if they're interested in broadcasting it. I've worked in the business for a while, so I have about a database of about 300 or so TV channels around the world that, of course, I will approach. I'm focused mostly on the U.S. because that's where this takes place, and this is where the soldiers live who are most effective. So that's the market I want to focus on, obviously. I will submit it to some film festivals, and if you're lucky, you get picked up by some film festivals. A lot of these buyers of documentaries go to these film festivals, so they might see it, and then you know, they might want to then purchase it. So that's a whole struggle in itself. After you get the documentary made, that's really just part one. The second part is really going out and seeing if you can interest people. But I have about 1,200 people on our documentary Facebook page, so I can try to get them involved, and they can write to Netflix and ask to see the documentary, and we can try a grassroots campaign. And basically, you just have to go out there and hit the road, start knocking on doors, and trying to drum up interest and find somebody who wants to buy it.
Well, let's direct some people to your Facebook page or other website or media accounts. Give us some ideas on how we can track you and track this documentary.
Well, you can go to Facebook.com and then / Burn Pits Documentary. It's all one word. So www.facebook.com/ Burn Pits Documentary. And that will take you to our page. And there you can see some short clips of the interviews that I posted from time to time while we were busy. You can also see the trailer for the documentary, which you can then share. It's actually been seen by about 250,000 people so far, which is pretty good. And you can stay up to date with our progress and what we're doing, and you can see how you might be able to get involved if you want to bring this to your local station or to Netflix or to HBO. And help us get distribution.
Well, I want to encourage all veteran radio listeners to go to Facebook, I just did it myself, put in the Burn Pits documentary into the search bar. It'll come right up. You'll see delay, deny, hope you die, pop up and like it and follow it. This is the sort of documentary I think that not only veterans should see, but policymakers, family and friends to understand what their loved ones went through when they were overseas in the sand pit. Is it your hope that this gets out into distribution in the next 6 months, next year? What's the normal distribution cycle, Greg, for a documentary?
Well, that can take a while. I mean, it can sometimes, you know, take upwards of a year, but I hope in this case that it doesn't take that long. I hope that people realize that this is a unique story, but it's also something that's happening now. It's current. I mean, you see soldiers in the documentary who are sick and dying now, and they need help. Their family needs help, and the more people that find out about it, the better. And I actually just did an interview with a reporter from Fox News in L.A. a couple weeks ago. She had seen the trailer, and she was interested. And, I mean, this is somebody who works in, you know, the television and media business, and she knew nothing about this. And I think the majority of people don't know anything about it. And actually, one of the doctors told me that he thinks the majority of soldiers don't even know about this. He thinks that there's a lot of soldiers out there who may be tired and winded and coughing or having rashes or other kinds of illnesses or irritations and not immediately link it to the burn pits. Right now, there are estimates of about 100,000 sick soldiers. He thinks that could be many more.
Well, and unfortunately, there are private doctors, and most veterans go to private doctors. Certainly, their private doctors wouldn't make that link, and even their VA doctors won't make that link. And I think that's why awareness is important, so you can, whether you're a spouse of a soldier or a soldier, say, hey, you know, since you can't really figure this out, could it be this? He lived here for 12 months and breathed this stuff in. Is that a possibility? And I suspect that that's what your documentary film here on burn pits would do, is sort of make people aware enough to ask a question.
I hope so, because a lot of the problems for some of the lung issues that the soldiers are suffering from is in the diagnosis. Dr. Miller at Vanderbilt University, who was really one of the first one to link some of these illnesses with the burn pits, discovered certain things only because he did lung biopsies. Now, I'm not a doctor, obviously, but a lung biopsy is apparently a pretty invasive operation. And so, for example, some of the soldiers were coming in and complaining that they just were out of breath. I used to be able to run, you know, my 2 miles in 10 minutes or whatever regulation time is. And I can't do that anymore. I mean, I feel okay, but I'm winded. And they would do normal examinations, CT scans and pulmonary function testing and that kind of thing. And those all turned out to be perfectly normal. It was only when he actually went deep into the lungs that he would find tears in the lungs, that they would find metal deposited in the lungs. And the problem is the VA doesn't cover a lot of these invasive kind of surgeries, because they just look at the basic facts and say, well, look, you do these tests and there's nothing wrong with them. And he had to convince a lot of people, no, we need to actually physically go deeper into the body to figure out what's going wrong. He did that with a couple dozen soldiers, and he discovered that they're really suffering, a lot of these people, from a disease called constrictive bronchiolitis, which is a terminal lung disease in which the lining of your lung is actually destroyed. But then what happened was, when he reported his findings to the Department of Defense, who was actually referring some of these sick patients to him, the Department of Defense decided not to send any soldiers his way anymore and just sort of deny the research that he's been doing and the information that he'd collected.
Well, that's a sad state of affairs, but unfortunately not one that's terribly surprising to somebody who works in this area.
Yeah.
I want to thank you, Greg Levitt, for taking some time out today to talk to us about your very important and informative documentary. I want to encourage our veteran radio listeners to go to Facebook, go look for the Burn Pits documentary so that you can follow it.
It's just Burn Pits documentary with no the.
Ah, okay, excellent. Get the word out about this to people. I want to thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.